Welcome to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Monday, February 13th, 2023. Of course, my website is therealistreport.com, where you will find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other programs I participate in. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, and many other useful and important links. I am on Twitter and Gab at @realistreport. And you can find me on Telegram at t.me/TheRealistReport. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to and help edit The Barnes Review, a bi-monthly revisionist history magazine. Please do subscribe to these fine print publications if you do not already. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for all the details. All right, today I am joined once again by John Massaro, author of Will Vaccines Be the End of Us? All right, John Massaro, welcome back to the program, sir. How are you this afternoon?
I'm doing well, John. Thanks for having me back on.
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much for joining me once again. Of course, you are the author of the must-read book, Will Vaccines Be the End of Us?, which is available directly from your website, which is endtheshots.com. And it's also available from the American Free Press bookstore. And I, of course, encourage all of our listeners to pick up a copy of the book. It really is one of the best books on the topic of vaccines. And it's one of the most enjoyable and enlightening books that I've read in some time. And I don't say that lightly. It is a very, very good read. It's very genuine, a very well-written book, very easy to read and digest. Although, of course, the subject matter is very deadly serious. So I did want to just mention that the book is excellent. How's the book doing, by the way?
Well, you know, the problem with me is I just want to keep things simple. You know, I think I mentioned to you once, I self-published a book about a humorous book when I was a high school and college level baseball umpire for 24 years. And I wrote a funny book about that called Please Don't Kill the Umpire back in 1999. And I dealt with credit card companies, and I really tried very hard to market it the best I could, and it didn't really. I said to myself, you know, if I'm ever going to write and self-publish a book again, I'm just going to keep it simple, and take orders to a post office box, and then just work with people like American Free Press. I'm working with a few other outfits that I support. And hopefully they can sell a bunch of copies. I didn't do this for the money. I just want to, you know, when you put that much of your heart and soul into a book, you just want your message to get out to people. So
yeah, exactly.
So I've sold. Just to answer your question, I think I've sold about 100 from my PO box. I made the mistake when I wrote my umpire book of printing 5,000 copies, and it took me 5 years to sell 2,300 copies. So this time around, I just had 1,000 copies printed. You know, if it should catch on, I'll be happy to do another printing. But so far, I've sold about roughly 100 from my PO box and about 200 through AFP and the other outfits I'm working with. So I've sold about 300 copies so far. But then again, I don't know. It's also up on my website. People can read the entire book for free. So, and I've received some nice feedback from people who read it on my website. So I really don't know how many people are out there that, you know, have read it online. As compared to the book itself, but
right, okay.
So
interesting. Well, if you don't have a copy of it, you need to get one for your library. Like I said, it is an outstanding book. To kind of move on, great interview you did with Giuseppe over on Speak Free Radio, I think is the official name of the platform.
Okay.
Yeah, I did listen to that. Yeah, yeah. We talked briefly yesterday, and I know you mentioned you were on with him, and I had it downloaded on my phone. I just hadn't had a chance to listen to it yet. And I listened to it this morning while I was lifting weights, and great conversation with him. I am a regular guest, regular sort of co-host on his Sunday night program. Although the past Sunday that I was scheduled to be on and this upcoming Sunday, I'm actually not even going to be able to do it, unfortunately. Sunday evening is kind of a weird time slot for me. And it's always been difficult for me to maintain like a live regular radio program just because my schedule is so crazy and it changes a lot. So, but anyways, I do a regular show with him, and I know, you guys have been doing like a once a month type interview, and it's always, you know, really good to hear you on the air with other people. So I just wanted to mention that. And I don't want to spend too much time on the vaccine issue because we've, you know, we've covered it pretty extensively. And a big part of the conversation you had with Giuseppe yesterday was focused on the vaccine issue. So I'd encourage people to go listen to that. But I did just want to mention that I recently, and I had sent you an email about this a couple weeks ago. I recently watched a documentary called Anecdotals, which you can find simply on YouTube. Shockingly, it's actually still available on YouTube. If you just search Anecdotals movie on YouTube, it should come right up. They have a YouTube channel. Or you can go directly to their main website for the documentary, which is anecdotalsmovie.com. And I'll have a link to that when I post this podcast program, by the way. So if anybody missed that, I'll have a link in the show notes. But it's really like a very just devastating, heartbreaking documentary to watch.
It's very heartbreaking. And, yeah. You know, there are other sites out there. There's one called, maybe we went over this once before, C19VaxReactions.com, who is run by a guy named Ken Ruckers, who used to be a tackle for the Green Bay Packers. His wife is in pretty bad shape from the Moderna shot a couple of years ago.
Wow.
There's about 500.
Yeah.
There's about 500 videos and written testimonies about what people are going through. And there's realnotrare.com. And then on the Jeff Frentz program, he's been doing a conversation with a woman named Erica Kahn, and that runs about an hour each. I think they do it three times a week, and he spends part of that hour just focusing on individual personal stories that he gets off social media. So there's so many people are hurting from this out there. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah, and realnotrare.com is one of the main websites that I follow that posts two or three times. Yeah, usually they have a post that comes out two or three times a week, where they just do a basic like Q&A with somebody that's been vaccine injured over the course of the past couple of years since the rollout of the whole COVID vaccines. But all these stories.
I just want to say the one problem I have with them, and also with Ken, even though he's a very decent man, is that they say they insist they're pro-vaccine, pro-science. So I mean, just people, they cling to this dogma and they just can't see the whole picture. But
I agree. Yeah. Well, they don't want to be smeared with that anti-vaxxer label, which is
exactly
another one of these weaponized buzzwords like anti-Semite or racist or white supremacist. So I agree, but the information is very important, and I think it has the potential to reach a lot of people. I mean, these stories that continue to come out about vaccine damage and injured people are really devastating. I mean, people across America have been literally maimed. They've had their entire lives turned upside down and largely destroyed. I mean, a lot of these injuries are life. They're going to be
permanent,
with them,
permanent,
yeah, permanent for
permanent
life.
Disabilities, yep.
And and there's just been some horrific injuries, some horrific side effects from the COVID shot. And it's interesting watching the documentary and also following the realnotrare.com website is when you hear these people talk, almost all of them say that they took the shot due to social pressure or a doctor's advice or from listening to the mass media and the quote-unquote public health establishment, or a lot of them will say that they did it because they wanted to quote unquote get back to normal. And, you know, they felt like they had to take it in order to keep their job and to like, you know, participate in society essentially. So all of that, you know, that is basically to say that very few of these people, probably none of them, made an informed, educated, rational decision to take the vaccine. Their decision was made as a result of pressure or fear or even outright coercion, and it really made me realize just how important it is to think critically for yourself and to never
experts. You mentioned about people that were scared about losing their jobs. I mean, I know a few people like that really didn't want to do it. They had good intuition, and I think a lot of pilots did it for that, and pilots are very intelligent, responsible men, you know, I mean, a lot of them, I think we went over some of the videos that are out there. Captain Robert Snow, he went to cardiac arrest April 9th last year, 6 minutes after touching down at Dallas-Fort Worth, and he did an interview from his hospital room, blaming the whole thing on – fortunately, he was resuscitated. He did an interview from his hospital room, point-blank blaming the shot. And there's another one with a pilot named – veteran pilot Greg Pearson – And he was joined by a dust cropper in Mississippi, Cody Flint. And yeah, their stories are just terrible. And they can't fly anymore. They're all Flint. I remember he has neurological problems. And Pearson thought he was going to die. He said his heart was beating out of his chest 14 hours after the shot. And he rushed himself to the emergency room. And, you know, he did survive, but neither of those men can fly anymore. So, and he said there's a lot of pilots out there. A lot of his colleagues that he's in touch with are flying with chronic chest pains, you know, which is kind of scary when you think about the next time getting on a plane, you know, if you do get on a plane. So, but by the way, John, I don't know if we mentioned, you know, I don't want to, you know, we want to get into Africa, but just to quickly add, I don't know if I mentioned this. We spoke about vaccines in the past. I came across a great website, howbadismybatch.com. Are you familiar with that website?
Yeah, I think you've mentioned it on previous podcasts. Yeah,
oh, it's great. Yeah, just scroll down and you can. There's just so much information on there. I mean, you could be occupied for a year just checking out everything on that site. And yeah, well, you know, if people, you said I mentioned that on Giuseppe's show yesterday too. Some of the details on that. So you know,
interesting.
Yeah. So.
Well, I just wanted to bring this up because, I mean, again, it really made me realize how important it is to just – I mean, you are in charge of your own body. You should not be letting other people make decisions that, you know, if you don't feel safe or comfortable taking a vaccine, you shouldn't – you know, you shouldn't have to. And, you know, sadly, a lot of people did and they regret it big time. And really what's interesting, not to beat this subject up, but I just saw a headline in the New York Times that New York City ended the vaccine mandate. You know, they got like 96% of people that work for the city to take the vaccine. And I wouldn't even be surprised if it's higher than that. You know, certainly if you wanted to keep your job, apparently you had to take the vaccine. But, you know, I don't know. I guess what I'm getting at is that it's just incredible how few people had the courage to stick by their convictions, especially those that knew something was up and that this was fishy and they didn't want to take the vaccine. And yet they, you know, still did because they felt like they had to or whatever. It's just what a just disgusting reflection on our society in general, I think.
Yeah, it sure is. And it's we don't even know what the future consequences are going to be. I mean, there's going to be a lot of new cancers, a lot of infertility, I'm sure, you know. So it's very, I don't know. The only bright spot, if you can call it a bright spot, is probably the fact that I went over this with Giuseppe yesterday. He said about 70% of the shots that were given in the States were saline solution or some placebo. I mean, there was nothing harmful in them. I don't know. And
right. Yeah.
So.
Who even knows? I mean,
nobody knows.
Yeah, exactly. Nobody even knows. You're basically playing Russian roulette with this,
exactly.
You know, taking the vaccine. So, but anyways, let's jump into today's topic. And that, of course, is your travel experiences in Africa, The Heart of Darkness, which is also the title of a very interesting book I remember reading in high school by Joseph Conrad.
Yeah,
I haven't read that book for years, and I don't even remember all the details, but I'd like to go back and read it again just to see how like PC it is, or like does it promote like some of these like anti-white narratives of colonialism? I know it's sort of critical of colonial rule in Africa, but I don't remember exactly
what
the
I want
details.
To do. Remind me if in case I forget. I'm probably going to go on and on. I just want to mention the 1980s were my Africa obsession decade. That's I went there 81, 82, and 88. I read about 50 books over there in that decade. And I want to just mention some of my favorites that I highly recommend to people. I would like to recommend to people if they really want to get a real picture of what's going on there. I haven't been there now. And like I said, the last time I was there in 88, so what is that, 35 years ago? But I can guarantee you that conditions are – nothing has really changed. As a matter of fact, one of my favorite books was written by Albert Schweitzer in 1922. That's one of the books I wanted to mention.
Yeah, I actually have that in my outline
you
here
do?
To
oh,
ask it. Yeah,
it's a wonderful
yeah,
book.
Exactly.
And well, you read that and you realize I read that in 60 years after it was written, and I said, you know, nothing has changed. It's still the same. So,
interesting. So, well, just to kind of get started, last interview we did, we discussed your journey to North Korea, And today, again, like I mentioned, I want to specifically focus on your travels to Africa. So just to kind of kick things off, can you give us the details of your travels to Africa? Where and when did you go? I know it was like three separate trips, right, in the 80s?
Yeah. Yeah, totaling about 5 months, a little over 5 months. All right, my first trip I went there was 1981. And I went, you know, I should say it is possible to travel. Africa is the one continent I never traveled alone. Although the third trip, which I'll bring up, I do with my ex-wife. I could have easily done that alone. But the first two, I'll start with the first one. It was, and you can do it alone, but it's just so difficult and so exasperating, as I found out. I went with a British outfit called Gerba. And by the way, back then in the 70s and 80s, there were some what they used to call overlanding companies. They were all, as far as I know, all based in England. There weren't many, maybe three or four of them. And they did some pretty, really adventurous stuff. And I went on the web, and there's really nothing left of that, at least in West Africa and through Central Africa. I mean, the continent is just so volatile that I can't see. They probably just said, you know, this is just not worth it. Because anything can happen, and they still do a fair amount of stuff in, I would say, the southern quarter of the continent, but nothing like what I did. So I'm going to go over my first one. We started in Tunisia. It was like two Land Rovers. It was all camping, and we carried light provisions, like macaroni, rice, some canned meat, this sort of thing, and we just supplemented that with whatever we could find in markets along the way. Anyway, we started in Tunisia, which, of course, is Arabic North Africa. It's not Black Africa. Then we went down to Algeria, and that's when, you know, this feeling of remoteness, you get down to southern Algeria, and it's just, you know, you're just like in a different – you cross on the Sahara Desert, and it was really kind of interesting. It's people have these images of these beautiful sand seas. We saw very little of that. Mostly it was like flat and gravelly. And after a while, but there's no –
real quick question. Anything similar to any of the deserts you'd see here, like in the western part of America?
I would say – well, I've been through Nevada. I mean, I would say – I don't know. I mean there's really nothing there. I mean, you just every 100, 200 miles, you'll hit a little town or something like that.
Any mountain ranges?
Yeah, there are, but we didn't go through any. I mean, there are in Algeria. There are certain peaks here and there, but we didn't really see that. It was mostly flat. And it was in September. It was pretty hot, but it wasn't crazy hot. It was I don't even think it reached 100, maybe in the high 90s. It wasn't really it wasn't overwhelming or anything like that. But after a while, you know, there's no pavement left, and all you do is follow tire tracks in the sand. And about every mile or two, there's a 55-gallon drum as a beacon just to make sure. And, well, you know, they had compasses and stuff. You know, you don't want to get lost. And so that's basically what it was. And then we just worked our way down to Algeria, to southern Algeria. Then you hit, I have to say this, there's certain images – I'm going to talk about things. There are certain images I'll never forget that are forever stamped on my brain, and I just can't be able to get them across just speaking about them. But one of them was crossing the border into Niger. You know, it's the country. You want to be careful with your pronunciation, Niger. And the border there it's just an old French sandstone fort called Fort Assamaka. Now you know you're in Black Africa. Although the transition from Arabic North Africa into Black Africa is like very gradual, and it's very, very exotic. A lot of exotic people. And I remember we crossed that border into Niger, and that's when you know you're in Black Africa. I mean, we had to wait there for a couple of hours. It's in the absolute middle of nowhere, and these black soldiers come out. I still remember they were dressed in like flip flops and torn fatigues, sunglasses, just ordering us arbitrarily this bag, that bag. Don't want to see, just shouting at us, open up this bag, that bag. And then finally we got through that, and we proceeded south. And we went through. Now, I have to say this. One thing, very maybe I should have mentioned this earlier. You have to remember about Africa is that nearly every, there's about 55 countries in Africa, and I think just all of them but two, I think Liberia and Ethiopia, were the only ones that were never colonized by Europeans. So, and the great majority were former French or British colonies. And in that part of Africa, it's mostly French. So just the French language, you know, I took French in high school. It's one of my regrets is that I never became fluent in it. But it's kind of a very, kind of an alluring kind of veneer of culture on Black Africa, just the French language everywhere, you know? And it's like a unifying language. There's a lot of local tribal languages, but French is the official language in much of West and North Africa. So we worked our way down through Niger. As I said, the northern part of the country was very exotic. Then as you get further and further south, you start seeing there's an area called the Sahel, which is where you start seeing plant growth, you know, and then it starts, and you get more into tropical Africa. And that whole belt, if you go east to west, like Mauritania, Mali, Niger, Chad, Sudan, of course, I've only been in Niger, and I was in the capital of Chad, but it's a very transitional area, and it's very, very fascinating. I mean, I've gone on the YouTube and just to see stuff about Mali and Mauritania. Anyway, we went through Niger, and I really had no problems, except that I have about 5 stamps on my pet. We had to stop at a police station in every big town. They collect passports and everything, and yet they're very, very, have to be very careful about photography in these West African countries. Some of them, I think in Niger, we needed a permit, but we didn't really have any problems. And we went down through. The next country we hit was Upper Volta, which that's what it was called then. Now it's called Burkina Faso. And we were just there for like 2 days. And all I remember there was extremely poor, very, very impoverished country. We didn't go through, unfortunately, that the capital of that country is called Ouagadougou, or I think it's pronounced Ouagadougou. I would have loved to say.
Wow, what a cool name.
Yeah, that's how it's spelled, Ouagadougou.
Ouagadougou. It sounds like,
but,
that's
yeah,
crazy.
And we didn't hit that. And, you know, I should also say that the part of Africa I'm talking about so far is also very Islamic. You know, you see a lot of mosques. Anyway, we went to Upper Volta, then down to Togo. Now, Togo is a very... I'm looking at the map. I have a whole map of Africa in front of me right here. It's just like a string bean of a country, very thin, like a finger. And in Togo, now you're in the tropics more. You know, it's really like the rainforest part of Africa. But in Togo, you know, in these countries, especially in this part of Africa, there's a lot of road checkpoints. And in Togo, of all the countries I've been to, they were very, very hassling. I mean, these guys were just, you know, you're just driving along. All of a sudden, there's a rope across the road, what's the French word for doesn't come to me right now. It's like the police, gendarme. You know, they have the old French term gendarme. So these guys were very hassling, and I remember one stop, and it was very kind of. It was very unnerving. I found it very unnerving, kind of scary. I mean, these guys, I just like no brains at all. When we got stopped at one checkpoint, the guy told us to undo the tarp, and then he just climbs up on top of the Land Rover and he just starts throwing some bags in the street, and then he just yells, "Who owns these? Open it up! I want to see this. I want to see that." And you know, it's just very unnerving. These guys got they have the sidearms and the uniforms, the whole bit. And then he said to the driver, told him that he committed an infraction because when he pulled the tarpaulin down, it covered up the license plate. I mean, that's the kind of the mentality you're dealing with some of these people. And I didn't know. I thought he was going to keep us there forever, maybe even arrest us. I don't know. But then what happened was another. I still remember another a local showed up in a taxi, and his partner started hassling him. And then there was a shouting match, so he kind of waved us off, and he went to join his partner, taking care of this other guy. So, but the people themselves, I mean, the black Africans, I mean, I would say, especially in the countryside, I would say 90% of them are really, really mellow. I mean, they don't see, they have no, very few, you know, these people are living in very primitive conditions. There's no electricity, you know, they don't see the newspaper every day, listen to the radio. So their only knowledge of white people is really the Peace Corps types and people that come when there's some kind of disaster, people that volunteers that come down to help, or doctors. So they sense that they're just not agitated. There's no Jewish media there to condition them to hate whites. So all I know about white people is what they've seen, and what they've seen of white people is mostly very good people, and so they kind of reciprocate that way. They're very, very, most of them are very friendly towards whites. The one caveat I have to mention here is that you always have to be on guard for petty theft. I mean, it will, and I don't blame them. I mean, they're, as I found out later on, I'll get into that. I mean, once you find out you don't have too much, I mean, you know, especially clothes, they'll just grab. We would have times where we would have stuff hang, where there was water, we would just hang stuff out to dry, and if you just got to keep your eye on everything, or it'll just disappear. But not, again, not violent, just petty theft. Petty, sneaky theft was my biggest, one of my biggest concerns there. That
right.
Malaria, I mean. Malaria is, you know, people don't realize malaria is and always has been a major world killer. So I was really fastidious about, you know, avoiding mosquito bites. I think I read a statistic once that every 30 seconds a black African dies of malaria. I mean, it is really, you know, people don't realize that. A lot of people go there very naive, where they take pills. You know, I took pills myself. That's one of the few things I took as a preventive medication. And but even they supposedly don't work all the time. So that was my other big concern. So anyway, we went back to Togo.
So this first journey, you started in Tunisia and just went basically directly south.
Yes.
And ended up in Togo. And then did you go return or did you fly back from Togo?
No, we ended up in Ghana, right next door.
Okay, yeah.
Now, Ghana was a British – it's one of the few countries in that region that was a British colony. And we drove along the coast, and we went to the capital of city of Accra. Now, that was one of my – that was a pretty scary experience. Nothing racial or anything, but things – were really coming apart in that country. I mean, there was like anarchy in the streets. I remember there was a riot outside of a food store and a big crowd. And I remember seeing police. I was just watching from a distance, seeing police just like wading through this crowd, just beating people with clubs. You know, I mean, you just see these clubs going up and down. And we stayed. We camped. Sometimes we would camp outside a hotel just to have access to their facilities. And there was a woman, an American woman and a daughter in my group who had stayed in the hotel. Everything's run down. There was a swimming pool there, but it was empty and everything was all cracking and everything. Anyway, she was in her room. She said some guys had come in from the town looking for their boss or something. And then she said that she was scared out of her mind. Not for herself, really, but apparently they wanted to kill this guy, and they ended up, they found his car there, and they ended up dragging it away in chains. And you know, then I'm walking through town, and I see this man just laying in the middle of the street, stark naked, you know, not a stitch on him. And I was like, wow, this is scary. I just want to get the hell out of this place. You know, I did have an air ticket back home. And then 2 months later, 2 months after I left there, this is in October of 81 now, they had a coup, and you know, I don't know what happened from there. They, you know, there's some new guy, Lieutenant Jerry Rawlins or something, he took over. But I guess the point I'm trying to make is you don't want to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And that, there was nothing racial. You know, I didn't feel any threat being white or anything over there. But it was just when law and order starts breaking down in an African country, it gets pretty scary.
Ooh, I can imagine. It gets pretty scary here in America as well when you saw like the Black Lives Matter riots back in like 2020. Yeah, things get pretty intense pretty quickly. I've got a question real quick. A lot of this, like at least the southern part of your journey when you got into Togo and Ghana, was pretty much along the coast. What were the beaches like?
Oh, the beaches were beautiful, but we were warned not to swim. Apparently, there was a very, very bad undertow, we were told. So basically, we just Lomé, the capital of Togo, I think. As I recall, I'm looking at the map right now. Yeah, I think it sits right on. Yeah, I remember we had an outdoor dinner. It was very nice near the beach. Very hot though, very hot and humid. The beaches were beautiful. I mean, you see the fishermen go out, and but again, we were warned not to swim because it was a very, very strong undertow. So I don't think anybody went for a swim.
What was the like the food and the water situation like?
Well, again, we had provisions with us, and we would stop now and then. There are markets here and there. You can buy eggs sometimes. Sometimes a cut of meat. Of course, the meat is just hanging on a hook in the sun. But you just cook. You know, we did all our. Every once in a while, we would eat out if there was a decent restaurant. And when I say restaurant, there's nothing like. In the capital cities, yes, but not in the outside of the really big cities. There's really nothing like a restaurant that you would call a restaurant. Well, as far as water goes, as I've always said, I'd never take chances with water. It's got to be boiled or bottled. And as I recall, that you know, bottled water was available back then, or you could have a beer or a soda or something like that. I'll tell you one time I did get sick in Niger. I still remember this. You know, sometimes I like to take chances. There was this guy walking around with a bucket of little metal bucket full of fried intestines. You know, I like to try everything, so I tried that and I got pretty damn sick. But just for a couple of days, you know, just the usual vomiting and diarrhea with the frustrating cold B&D.
You were much braver than I would be. I would not be trying. I don't think I would try that.
I figured it was cooked well, but I guess I was wrong. So, that was the only time I got sick, and on that trip, and I mean, we you just buy stuff. You know, tropical fruits are available, some vegetables. So you do the best you can, and I remember there was fish. We had a fish dinner in Ghana. I remember my last meal in Ghana was had chicken rice, and I took a chance. Again, you take chances with salads too, but I did have a couple of salads, and I got away with that. So that was my first trip. You know, and then I said to myself, my experience in Togo. I just found it very intimidating. I remember thinking to myself, how could any white person put up with this kind of degradation, this humiliation? These really stupid guys, these gendarmes, just hassling us like that. It just didn't. I said, you know, I don't want to go through this again. And yet, there's something about Africa. I don't know. It just grows on you. There's something magical about it. I can't. You'd have to go there to experience it. I mean, it's just looking back now, 40 years later on these trips. I mean, it's just such an incredible experience having seen these countries that so few people have seen. So at the end of that trip, I said to myself, you know what? I'm going to go back to Africa. So we go back the next year at 82. My next trip it began in Nairobi. So we went through Kenya. This is with a group. You know, I did see a handful of people, of white people, doing it alone, but it was just too. It just seems. You know, I have to say this too. I can't. Being white and in Africa, I just could. I couldn't bear being the center of attention all the time. You're always going to be mobbed by. No, I'm not mobbed, but people are always going to come around you. They're just. You know, not in a hostile way. They're just very interested. They want your address. They want to talk about things. And I just didn't want to be. I wanted to go with the group. I just couldn't see myself going through that alone. I mean, I just wanted to share it with other people of my background. You know, that's the way I felt about it. And so the following year in 82, I flew to Nairobi in Kenya. That trip was I'll go country by country. Kenya. Now, Kenya, I would say there was more racial hostility there, which was kind of strange because it's one of the better off countries that I went to. I mean, Nairobi itself had a lot of amenities, a lot of souvenir shops. You know, a lot of tourists go there. You know, they have the game parks there. And but I there was a sense of racial hostility here and there, not all the time. And we camped out the first, I think, the first or second night we camped out. We went down to a town called Mombasa, another city. And we camped on the beach there, very, very hot, very uncomfortable. I still remember we were staying in tents and I just couldn't. The heat was unbearable. Anyway, there was two women in our group and we were warned not to wander off on our own, just to stay with the group. So these two women went off on their own and they ended up getting mugged by they went for a walk on the beach, you know, a ways from where we were camping, and they got mugged by two men with machetes. They didn't hurt them, but they took a lot of cash. They took their cameras, and then we got held up for a full day because they filed a police report. And I still remember there was the local police. They went for a ride with them in their Jeep with a German Shepherd. I still remember I saw it. And they went looking for these guys, but they never found them. And but you know, another thing, even in Nairobi now, I remember, just to show you how the savagery is just below the surface, I still remember there was one site I still remember, outside of a bank, this armored truck pulled up to either make a deposit or a pickup, and four guards got out, and two of them were holding clubs and the other two are holding machetes on the walkway to the bank. So it just gives you an idea of how, you know, the savagery, anything can break out at any time. As a matter of fact, I think it was a few months after I was in Kenya, there was a coup at the airport where I landed, and there was all kinds of gunfire and stuff. So there's a lot of stuff that's just below the surface. Now, I was speaking of one of the most magical moments, though. I think the fourth or fifth day we were in Kenya, we decided, let's not make breakfast. Let's not go through the chore. Let's just go eat at we were at the Amboseli Game Reserve, and we stopped at, there's a place called the Kiliguni Lodge, and very rustic lodge, and it was overlooking a water hole where all the animals were coming to drink in the morning, and there was Mount Kilimanjaro in the distance, and these waiters, black waiters with jackets and bow ties, serving us a full English breakfast. I mean, it was just absolutely magic. You know, just looking out over that waterhole with all the animals and Mount Kilimanjaro. It was just one of those moments of my life that I wish I could preserve forever. But anyway, we moved on to Tanzania. Now, Tanzania at that time was a lot much poorer than Kenya. Very few amenities, really nothing. Although we had a great time. We went to the Serengeti. We did a drive in the Serengeti Game Reserve, and we camped out in the Ngorongoro Crater, which is just full of, you know, just teeming with wildlife, just an incredible experience. And then we moved on to Rwanda. And this is another thing I spoke a minute ago about savagery being just below the surface. Now, Rwanda is a very small country. And we crossed at the border post. I remember it was a Sunday morning. There was nobody there. So we had to give a little boy some pocket change just to go find an official to stamp our passports. And eventually this guy shows up like 20 minutes later, just, I guess he just got out of bed, shows up on his scooter, stamped all our passports. And then we just went over a rickety bridge into Rwanda. I guess that was on the Rwanda side. And anyway, the point I want to make was, like 8 years later or six years later, you remember the Hutu and Tutsi genocide, right?
Yeah, yep.
I remember there was a photo taken right at that very spot where we crossed that. It was so sleepy. There was like nothing going on. And then I remember seeing a photo at that very spot looking over the river. I think it was the Ruzizi River, just clogged with dead bodies, just massacred Tutsis, you know, hundreds and hundreds of bodies. So it's just like, there's stuff going on below the surface that you can't, you're not always aware of. That's Africa, you know. So then we didn't spend too much time in Rwanda. It was okay. It was kind of mountainous, a lot of rice terraces, I remember. And then we went into the Congo, which then was called Zaire. It was renamed Zaire. And that is, John, I'm telling you, John, we're going to run out of time here because I can just go on and on with this stuff. But are you familiar with what happened in the Congo in 1960 when they got their independence? Do you know that story?
No, refresh my memory. Or maybe I'm somewhat familiar with it, but.
Yeah, well, the Congo is the one country in Africa where I really was scared a lot. A lot of racial antagonism. Not everybody, you know, maybe, but a lot of them. A lot of people were really. What happened was they got their independence from Belgium in 1960, and then the place just. We could do a whole show on just what happened in the Congo. The whole place just went, just collapsed into total anarchy. You know, cannibalism, tribal massacres everywhere, and there were about 110,000 Europeans, mostly French and Belgian, living in the country up to 1960. About half of them sensed what was going to happen and left before Independence Day, and the other half stayed there hoping for the best. And then all hell broke loose. I mean, they tried escaping into neighboring countries. Whites were being murdered and a lot of women raped left and right. It was just complete. It just broke down into absolute hell. I remember the Belgian airline, Sabena, they canceled all their scheduled flights. And they sent a whole fleet of airplanes down into the Congo to evacuate everybody. I mean, it's a very, very harrowing story. But again, I don't want to run out of, we can run out of time talking about this. But anyway, what happened, now the Congo really is kind of exceptional because whereas in the French, much of French, the former French colonies, the French really kind of kept their presence there pretty strongly. And they still, when I was there, it almost felt like they were still colonies. I mean, the whites run everything. This is one of the things you'll never hear about in the news. Whites pretty much run everything where any kind of a technical expertise is required. They run the hospitals, they run the utilities, the airports, the schools. You'll always find them in the supervisory positions. And the blacks totally accept that as being totally natural. So, and in France, a lot of West Africa, much of that never changed, I don't think. But in the Congo, again, it just, Belgium just very abruptly gave them their independence, and most of the whites just fled there permanently, and very few ever returned. Some did stay on, but as a result of that, there is the whole country just regressed. So we. And Congo's a huge country. It's like it's much bigger than Alaska. I think it's the biggest country in Africa, area-wise. And there's no outside. I didn't go to Kinshasa, which is the capital city, but outside of the few big cities, there's just nothing. There are just villages. There are no petrol stations. You have to. You know, we had a lot of jerry cans on the. Now this was a military type truck for this trip. So we had a lot of jerry cans filled up before we left Rwanda. And, then we didn't have enough to get through the country. And so here and there, you just have to stop in villages. And people just hoard diesel fuel in 55-gallon drums. And you just try to make a deal or you do some kind of bartering and get what you can to get enough petrol to get you from point A to point B.
Man, so anyway, that sounds crazy. I don't know if I don't know if I could sign up for that.
It's the craziest thing I've ever done in my life.
That sounds pretty wild, man.
Now in Kisangani, which used to be Stanleyville, it was like about the halfway point. And at that point, I'll tell you, you learn a lot about yourself taking a trip like this. I mean, in the first few countries, at least we could here and there you could have a shower. Wash your clothes, maybe do laundry. You know, once you get into the Congo, there's really nothing. So, you know, you're washing your clothes and they never really dry out because it's so hot and humid all the time. And then some people started getting sick, and then we had a lot of personality conflicts, people just bickering about who's not putting up the tents, who's not pulling their weight, who's getting greedy. It started getting out of hand. But, you know, looking back, that's the way it should be. You know, it's when you read about Stanley's explorations, and you know, you realize just how. And of course, we had it so much easier than they had it back in the age of exploration in the late 19th century. But you realize just how tough it is getting through something like this. So it got to the point where in Kisangani, which was like, it's a big city. It's about 1 million people, and that was one of the worst areas for when the Congo exploded in the early 60s. And there was really just nothing, you know, no paved roads, just a few. I still have a vision of it, just people riding around on bicycles. There was one market there, really nothing going on, just like a ghost, you know, people, just the living dead, people walking around like zombies. And, you know, you say to yourself, this is the end of civil. You know, and I read back, you know, what it used to be when it was Stanleyville, when the Belgians were in charge, what a beautiful place it was. But everything has gone to ruin, everything. So me and two other guys were just so fed up with everything. And then the driver and one of the British guys that was on the trip came down with malaria. And we said, you know, these guys might die. I mean, this is just falling apart. I don't know what's going to happen. Are they ever going to leave Kisangani? And so we decided, one of these guys, it was an Australian and a German guy, Kisangani is right on the Congo River, and they found out that there was a bar, that there was a ferry leaving like 2 days later. So they asked me if they said they were going to split in the group, and they asked me if I wanted to join them. And I really had to do some serious thinking about that, because at least in the truck you had some kind of security. You know, you had, you know, assuming that we were going to get rolling again, at least you knew you had wheels under you. You know, but anyway, we split from the group. We went on the ferry, and on the second day it got stuck on a sandbar. And I remember it was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and it was just outside of a town called Bumba. We could see the town, actually. It was about a mile away, and they brought some old tugboats, rusted tugboats, to try to push us off, and they couldn't get us off. And I read later, this happens all the time. You know, sometimes these barges and ferries, which is really like their only connection to the outside world, they get stuck on these sandbars. So we took a motorized dugout canoe to land, and then we just proceeded on our own. And that was really the greatest adventure of my life, just getting through the rest of the Congo. It took us about 8 or 9 days, I guess. And you just sit by the side of the road and you just wait for a vehicle to come by. If you're lucky, maybe one a day will come by. And they're just completely old trucks, just falling apart, you know, grossly overloaded with cargo and people. You just wedge yourself in and just do the best you can. And they're constantly getting stuck in the mud. I mean, it was just an incredible experience. But we made it through. It was about 8 or 9 days.
Now, and again, just so, because I'm looking at the map and I'm just trying to follow along here. So basically,
yeah, listen, jump in anytime with your questions. Okay?
Yeah. So you guys are just literally floating down the Congo River, which kind of, if you look at a map, it ends up going all the way to the coast, I believe, right?
To Kinshasa. Yeah. No, we didn't go anywhere near that far. We didn't have any intention of going. So,
But it kind of it goes like east and west, like through the country, through
yeah,
the Congo.
Well, it's like a snake, not exactly east and west. Yeah, mostly east west. Yes. So again,
oh my
I don't
goodness.
Know if you're looking
and,
at
and like on a like an average day, or what are you guys doing? Just hanging out on the barge? Because I think in the article that I read, there was like three different barges like connected.
Yes, that's what it was. That's exactly what it was. It's a floating African city, and
how big were
the
barges? I mean, how many people could fit on it?
There were probably thousands of people on them. I mean, people wedged in everywhere. You know, and some of the people, I still remember we had conversations. I still remember this one guy, you know, they eat monkey meat. I still remember this one guy had a dead monkey in his lap. He's just shaving the fur off with a razor blade, you know, and people, and then these little canoes would come by, and they had a lot of dead monkeys. So they would just, they would barter for things, you know. They're sometimes, like anything, any simple thing, matches, cloth, they would just do like a bartering thing. These little dugout canoes, people would paddle out from the villages, and they would hitch onto the barge for a little while and just barter, and then just go back to their village. So,
Wow, it was really unbelievable.
Gross. I mean, the toilets, you know, just overflowing with excrement, and they would just like rinse it off with buckets. You know, you just want it was absolutely filthy and primitive.
Now, but, what was this? It had to have like stunk on that barge, right?
Well, around the toilets, it certainly did.
Whew, man.
Yeah. You know, I should mention too, there's no hotels or anything like that. We stayed, we would get a truck, and if it would make it to a fairly, I'm not going to say it, I'll say a town, like a big village or a town. Now, the only accommodations, there are no hotels whatsoever, but there are missionaries here and there that have spent, you know, that kind of stayed on from the old days. So we would ask, at the end of the day, we would say, you know, where's the mission? And, you know, most of the people, you know, on the trucks were pretty friendly, and they would tell us where it was. So we'd go there, and we would usually stay at a mission. These people would let us stay there overnight. No, I think just once I remember there was a bed. We would just have to – when we split from the group, we wanted to travel as light as possible, so we didn't even take our sleeping bags. We just took a ground cloth, and they would just give us an empty room, like sleep on a cement floor. At least you had a roof over your head, because, of course, you have a lot of tropical downpours. So that's what we stayed pretty much at missions every night. And these people, these were some of the saddest white people I've ever met. They just, you could just tell they had this, you could just, I just sense that they knew they wasted their whole lives coming down here to bring religion to Africa. They were just resigned about everything. Very heavy drinkers, constantly getting drunk. A few of them put on a nice dinner for us. But out, you know, and out came the wine or the booze and the beer. And their only connection really to the outside world is that there's a small airstrip. And so I guess from the larger cities, they would fly out in small airplanes just to bring supplies every now and then. So that's how we stayed through, you know, as we traveled through the Congo. Then we got, John, by the way, I know I'm going on and on with this, and I haven't even gotten into how much time do we have left?
Probably about 30 to 40 minutes.
Oh,
probably
God.
40 minutes at the very most, yeah. So, I mean, it's fine. I mean, we can, like I said, we're going to be doing this, you know, somewhat routinely. So, I mean, we can kind of, let's try to get through at least the three journeys that you went on.
I'm not sure I'm going to get to the third one, but well, let me quickly go across the next two. So we get out of, we finally make it to the Congo, and then right across the river is the next country, the Central African Republic, which is one of those countries that used to be a French colony. And then the capital city of Bangui, and that was like Disneyland. All of a sudden, you're in a capital city. There are some more amenities than there were in the Congo. There were a few restaurants, and we stayed at a real campground where we could shower and have a cold beer, and it was really nice being there for a few days. But that, you know, I got to tell you that country has really seen its ups and downs too. And right now, it's just that and the Congo, it's just impossible to travel to. There's just so much. I was on the internet, I remember about 5 years ago. I mean, just everything just breaking down. You know, one coup after another. I don't know if you're familiar with it. One of their dictators named Bokassa, Jean-Bédel Bokassa.
Ah, no, doesn't ring a bell.
Yeah, okay.
But I believe you. I can imagine how just chaotic the whole situation would be.
Yeah. So anyway, let me just try to go quickly. The next country we went to was Cameroon, and that's really one of my favorite countries in all of Africa.
Now, time out real quick. After you guys got off the barge, I mean, you didn't take the barge up to what's the name of the capital of the Central African Republic?
No, Kinshasa. Oh, no, it doesn't go there. It doesn't go into the Central African Republic. It goes to Kinshasa. And we had no intention of going to Kinshasa. That's down by the Atlantic Ocean. You know, we were going to get out somewhere, but we were forced to get out at a little town called Bumba. And that's when we started going by land.
Okay, I see. So when you got to Bumba, and then and you guys weren't with the organized group, so you were kind of
oh no, just
you
the
were
three
like
of us,
hitchhiking basically, or
just walking. We would walk and just sometimes you just stayed up by the side of the road and just wait for a vehicle to come by. We ran into two Canadians going the other way, and they hadn't seen a vehicle in 4 days. So if you sit, typically we'd sit there for about, it could be anywhere from like 4 hours to 8 hours, just sitting there doing nothing, just bored to death. And then a lot of the trucks we got on, I mean, I have so many stories, but just they would get stuck in the mud again. Or we would run into a truck that was stuck in the mud, and all these trucks carry winches. So, because they know, the story there, the conditions there, you're just going to have to get winched out. And, yeah, so we just, that's how we traveled through the rest of the
country.
Okay, gotcha. Three of us.
Yeah, wow, that's crazy, man.
And you find out, even among the three of us, we get very greedy. I mean, we're living on warm water, and most of the time, just bananas, canned sardines, and warm water. So you could get very, very irritated very quickly that way, And you can't wash your clothes properly. You can't take a shower. I was so filthy at the end of this trip. I mean, I can't even, I remember when I got home, it took me about a month. This is going to sound crazy. I was taking hot showers almost every day and just peeling all this gunk off my back. It's this film of sweat and dirt that had accumulated from that trip.
Oh my gosh, man.
Yeah,
wow.
And I lost about 15 pounds, but anyway, I'm not even going to have time to talk about South Africa, which I wanted to. Maybe we just concentrate more on the Congo, what happened there. We went to Cameroon, which is really one of my favorite countries. We happened to get there at Ramadan in the north of the country. What was the name of that? Marawa. And it was a big celebration at the end of Ramadan.
You were saying that you guys had just arrived in Marawa, which is like the very northern part of – is it Chad? No, not Chad. Cameroon.
Well, it's very – Cameroon, but it's right across the river from Chad.
Okay, right.
And that's one of the that's another thing we did when we were up there. I really, really enjoyed Cameroon. One of the crazy things we did was Chad was like in the middle of a civil war, and right across the river, I think it was right across the river from Marawa, is the capital of Chad, and Djamena. And we took a motorized dugout canoe across the river. And this is the way things are created. And we had no visas. There was a guy there right at the river, and he just let us in. And we spent, I'm going to say, 5 or 6 hours just in the capital there. And I have never been, of all the countries I've been to, I've never been in a war-torn country before. And there were just, every building was just peppered with bullet holes. There was shell casings all over the place. And there was no fighting going on at the time. There was like a temporary truce or something. But there were some vehicles just wheeling around. It was pretty scary, just with guns mounted. You don't know what the hell's going to happen. I was a little nervous. And just to show you how crazy things are in Africa, we went to the American embassy there. And the woman who was running things, she was an attractive blonde woman. She was Canadian, even though this was the American embassy, and she just couldn't believe that anybody was visiting the country at this time. And she brought us into she put on a really big dinner for us, like a Thanksgiving dinner. And it was so strange because I still remember there was a big color TV. I haven't seen that anywhere in Africa, with some movie playing. And she was a member of the Baha'i, the Baha'i religion.
Yeah.
It's kind of a strange, I don't know. So
definitely,
kind of
definitely
really,
very strange. Yeah.
Yeah. And she was really spaced out herself. And there was a little black kid living with them. She called him her son. It was just very bizarre. But what the strange thing was too, here's a woman. She's just had a lot of courage. She said her housekeeper had been hit by a stray bullet in her wrist. And she was just, she just hung on there. She just stayed in the embassy. A stray bullet came through. So, that was quite an experience going into a war zone. Again, I didn't hear any shooting going on, but the signs of war were just all over the place. So I was really, We were just happy to get out of there and get back into Cameroon.
So you guys just went over there briefly for like a day or so?
Not yeah, like 5 or 6 hours, just walking around.
Oh, okay.
You know, people were very friendly. You know, they would say, you know, and Chad is another one of the former French colony. You know, they would ask us in French, vous êtes français? No, américain. Oh, américain. Give me the thumbs up, you know. I mean, people were just, you know, in spite of the war and everything, and I don't know how many people died there. I mean, they were just, life goes on. So, and I guess they're just so accustomed to it. So anyway, so we got back into, we went back into Cameroon, and then we finished up in Nigeria. And I didn't see a whole lot of Nigeria. I ended up flying out from a city called Kano, which I believe is the second biggest city in Nigeria. Lagos is the biggest. Lagos is supposed to be the real hellhole, real urban hellhole of the whole country. But we didn't go there. We went to Kano.
Kano's like in the northern part of the country, I think, right? Let me see if I can
yes,
find it on the map.
Yes, it is. It's a big city. But, yeah, we just, you know, again, we were just – for the time we were in Cameroon, we didn't really run into not as many missions as in the Congo. So we would just find a secluded spot to just throw down our ground cloths, you know, put on a lot of bug repellent and just sleep, you know, just sleeping outside. Sometimes we were we would run into white people that gave us some accommodations, but we would just just grinded it out and did the best we could. Just so that was that trip in Nigeria. You know, I don't want to say a whole lot about it. I mean, and the officials were real bastards there, especially the border. The first guy refused to let us in, so we had to go down. No, he said something about Chad. We have the Chadian refugee. First, he shakes our hands, welcoming us into the country. Then he says, you know, I am so, you know, in that African accent, this border is closed. I'm sorry. We have the Chadian refugee problem. You cannot, you know, a real bastard, really just rubbing it in our faces. So we had to go down. We had to go back into Cameroon and just go back down to the next border post. And they let us in, no problem. I mean, just you never know what you're going to run into, especially at the borders. You know, it's just it's such an unpredictable continent. And so that's pretty much – and again, there's a million – remember I told you yesterday the story about that soldier pulling himself up in the Congo? His truck had broken down?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I have a million anecdotes like that, but we just don't have time to talk about it. So it's just – it could go on forever and ever with stories. By the way, you know, on my website, endtheshots.com, on the travel page, I have an Africa, the real, the big picture, Africa, the big picture. If people log on to that, they could read about, more stuff. And in the middle of that, I inserted a video which really shows what it's like crossing the Congo. This was made by a European film crew about 4 or 5 years ago. It's really excellent. And that will give you a real feeling of what it's like to cross the Congo.
I'll have a link to that post in the podcast program. I've got it pulled up.
Yeah,
right here.
Maybe even if you could put the YouTube, if you want to put, can you link right up to the YouTube?
Yeah, I probably could. I could probably put it in the comments. Yeah,
whatever you want to do. Okay. So, you know, I guess John, you know, we're running out of time. I'm not, you know, maybe we could. You want to talk about my South Africa another time? You want to do another show on that? Because
not gonna have. That's fine. Yeah, that would have been. The South Africa trip, that would have been your third and final journey to Africa.
And that's well worth talking,
right.
Well worth doing
yeah.
a separate show about. Just want to mention – go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I read through that article, the Africa, the Big Picture, and I pulled out some good excerpts from it. But no, go ahead. If you want to – I know you probably have a bunch of notes you want to get through, so why don't you go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to mention some books that have people – of all the books, I read must have been between 45 or 50 books, something like that, in the 80s. And my favorites, if you really want to get a picture of a good broad picture of what the continent is like, three of my favorite books, like I mentioned earlier, are Albert Schweitzer's On the Edge of the Primeval Forest. Absolutely wonderful book. This is a guy who just... He dedicated his life for the betterment of the black man in Africa. He was in a back then it was a French colony. It was called French Equatorial Africa back then, and the country now called Gabon. And there are just so many little stories, really a lot of touching stories. Sometimes he just throws his hands in the air. He just realizes he's just wasted his whole life. Why am I here? Just these people are impossible, you know. Yeah, and he was very racist. You know, no white man in the history of the world did as much as he did to alleviate these people of their pain, you know, their tropical diseases and stuff. So he was really dedicated. He just saw it as his Christian duty to do this, but he was very.
Speaking of that, you have this is actually one of the excerpts that I had from your article. You talk about this. What's his name? Albert Schweitzer, a German guy.
Schweitzer.
And I haven't read his book. I hadn't even really heard about him until reading your article. But you write that he basically argued that, quote, the superiority of the white man is so obvious to the African native that it ceases to be taken into account.
That's a direct quote.
And he said, one notable fact about modern Africa never mentioned in the controlled media is the total dependence on white intelligence and technical expertise. The hospitals, utilities, schools, factories, hotels, airports, and so forth, where they even exist, are run almost exclusively by whites, and the blacks who work under them as subordinates or servants consider themselves very lucky.
That's true.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So another book I mentioned, of all the crazy stuff, you know, we're not going to have time to go talk about what happened in the Congo, but one really excellent book. Have you ever heard of a guy named Mike Hoare? I pronounce his name, last name Hoare, H-O-A-R-E. Mike Hoare. Have you ever heard of him?
H-O-A. No, that doesn't sound familiar.
All right. This is a really great book, Congo Mercenary. He was, when the Congo exploded in the early 60s, he was a mercenary. And he was really a remarkable guy. He wrote this book, and this is specifically about the campaign in the there was a bunch of primitive, like BLM types, calling themselves the Simbas, which means lion in Swahili. And they took over like one third of the country. And they were just terrorizing everybody. And he was living, I think, in South Africa or Rhodesia at the time. And he put an ad in the paper and he just came up with a mercenary army to just go into the Congo and just drive these people out. You know, at this time, you have to remember, too, this was a time when a lot of these African countries had just gotten their independence, and communism was the Soviets and the Chinese were making big inroads at the time. So they were, and a lot of these black African leaders were pretty much communist puppets. And it's a very, very complicated story, but this is one of the greatest war books I ever read. It was an absolutely brutal, and this guy, he was a very emotionally rich, highly intelligent, great writer. It's such a great read. It's just an absolute ruthless bush war. I mean, they just had to just kill these Simbas where they found them. And yet he also recognized that, you know, he had a place in his heart for the ordinary black Africans who were terrorized by these people. As a matter of fact, there was one part in the book where they had to arm them just to, because these people were so scared of the Simbas, they were just terrified of them. And a lot of people don't realize that. I mean, there's a lot of goodwill between blacks who try to live a civilized life as best they can, and the white man in Africa. And they kind of, I wanted to talk about this as far as South Africa goes, so we're not going to have time. Basically, there were a lot of times when he had to depend on the local populations, and they assisted them every way they could. And also, what's interesting about this book is that some of the whites, you know, it was a white mercenary army, and there were some pretty rough guys there, and pretty messed up whites I'm talking about now, that too, that he had to kick out. And sometimes he had to discipline them, like, really brutally. One guy, I remember, he raped and murdered a black Congolese woman. So he had two of his officers hold this guy down, and he shot his big toes off. I mean, it's a brutal book. but it just shows the brutality of what went on there. You know, and there's one other. Are you familiar with a book called The Fabric of Terror by Bernardo Teixeira?
No, I'm not.
All right. This, in 1961, again, I'm talking about, this is right after the Congo blew up. This is about what happened in Angola, which then was a Portuguese colony just to the south of the Congo. And on one day, this band of this ragtag army of black terrorists crossed over into Angola. And on one day, March 15th, 1961, they butchered, just with machetes pretty much. They just took the sleepy northern Angola by surprise. And it was just like an assault on all these small towns. And they hacked probably about 1,000 whites to death and lots of blacks as well. Looking back, there was practically no news coverage of it at all. I remember researching this, and I remember seeing like two small paragraphs or a very small section of the New York Times, one page, that mentioned that. But you know, unless you were looking for it, you wouldn't even notice it. And then there was no news coverage of it at all. And this book, The Fabric of Terror, is about, and it's like some gruesome photographs in here. It's all about what happened on that one day. There was more that happened in the following days, but that one day was the real big one, March 15th, 1961. And this book, this guy, he was Portuguese, Bernardo Teixeira. He just, there's a chapter on what happened in each of the towns. He interviewed some people, some of the survivors, what they saw, how they hid from them, and whatnot. And it's really, if you want to see what African savagery is all about, what these people are capable of doing with the wrong kind of leadership, this is a really important book to read. And I don't know.
I wonder, like, how often is that sort of thing going on today? That, you know, well, we just don't even, you know, nobody even knows about.
I don't think there are a whole lot of massacres of whites. In the Congo, now there have been here and there. I know.
I don't even mean necessarily of whites, but just like this sort of, these sorts of conflicts.
Total mayhem.
It's got to be.
It blows up every now and then. Just about. I'm looking at the map of Africa now. Liberia, for example. Oh God, that place must be absolute hell. Total breakdown of law and order.
Well, and now Liberia was founded. That was the country founded by former black slaves in America, right?
Well, yeah. It was a back to Africa movement. The capital
exactly,
was Monrovia,
yeah.
which is named after James Monroe,
exactly.
Yeah, but it never took off. I mean, not many people went back. Of course, they had it much better in the States. So it was never a genuine, you have to understand, Africa is very tribal. And I don't think there's any tribal languages there. I mean, they speak English because they were, again, they were settled by American former slaves that went over there by boat in the early 19th century. So it's like kind of an artificial country it's artificial in the sense that there's no tribalism as you run into, because tribalism is very strong throughout Africa. You know, people identify with their tribe more than they do with the country, because these borders were pretty much drawn when these countries became independent. They were just arbitrarily drawn, and they're kind of meaningless in a lot of ways. I mean, you have Maasai's living in Kenya and across the border in Tanzania, and they feel a closer bond than they do than the typical Maasai in Kenya does to a Kikuyu, which is another tribe. So it's very, and politics are very tribal as well, all over the continent. So I just wanted to mention one of the book. I know we're running out of time. This is one of my favorite books. It's called The Last Ivory Hunter. And between these three books, between Albert Schweitzer's book, On the Edge of the Primeval Forest, Congo Mercenary, and this, The Last Ivory Hunter, the saga of Wally Johnson, it's called. I mean, you can get a really good full picture of Africa. Now, Wally Johnson, he was a hunter. However you feel about hunting elephants, he was a big hunter in the 1940s and 1950s. And there are so many little anecdotes, really kind of touching stories that really tell the whole story of what it's like to be in Africa. And he's another guy, just like Mike Hoare and Albert Schweitzer. He really had he really treated black Africans well, very fond of them for the most part. But he was like, you know, being a hunter and being a realist, as you will rapidly become if you're in Africa. He had no fantasies about what Africa was all about below the surface. And of course, Mozambique, that was another, that's just to the north of South Africa. That was a Portuguese colony. And he lost everything. And Portugal gave Mozambique its independence, I think, in 1975. And then the whole country exploded into civil war. And he lost everything he had. He had to flee the country. But, you know, I just want to tell, just to show you what a strange, what a bizarre kind of place, how you could run into the unexpected. He tells one really funny story about how, you know, back in those days, they would have their hunting concessions, and sometimes they would move to a new area. So the custom was to become acquainted with the chief in the local area that they didn't know. So he ran into the chief. He goes into a new area, and they start talking, and the chief invites him into his hut to have some tea. So he goes into his mud and dung hut, and what does he see? What does he see but a grand piano? A grand piano in a mud and dung hut, and he serves some tea.
Where the heck did he get that from?
I know, it's crazy. He serves some tea on a silver tea set. This guy speaks like perfect English. This is in a Portuguese-speaking country. So the chief told him his story. He had been educated in England. And he didn't like how he was treated there. So he said he wanted to get back into the bush and to his old way of life, you know, with his seven wives. And you just run into the craziest things. I'll tell you one other quick story. I have a million stories. When we were in the Congo, this guy asked us to give us this local guy. He was well dressed. He was carrying an attaché case. He asked us to give him a lift. So we did. He came on the truck for a little while, maybe half an hour. Then in the middle of nowhere, I mean, just in the middle of the jungle, nothing, no villages, he told the driver to stop, and he just walks into the jungle with his attaché case. And it's like the most unexpected things can happen. And
I certainly believe you. You know, I've got two kind of wrap-up questions, and man, you're right. There's a lot that we could definitely get to, and I have a bunch of notes here that we can pick up with the very next podcast that we do.
We got to talk about South Africa.
And there's a lot that I have that we haven't even had a chance to address.
Okay.
So two quick sort of questions to kind of wrap up. Number one. After visiting Africa, is there any doubt in your mind that race is a biological reality rather than a social construct that we're meant to believe in the West?
It's so obvious. it's not even – it's a question that doesn't even need to be asked.
Yeah.
And as you said earlier, as I mentioned in my composition, the Africans realize it. I mean, that quote by Schweitzer, the superiority of the white man is so obvious that's not even taken into account.
Well, it's just so blatant in your face. If you just look at the development of Africa, the history of Africa, I mean, it's just so obvious. I mean, and I've never been there, but certainly I could imagine it's even in more stark reality actually being there and seeing how these people live and just seeing their, and I don't even mean this to be insulting, but just lack of development when compared to Western Europeans. I mean, it's just, it shouldn't even be a controversial thing. It's just, it is what it is.
Left on their own, you know, without any contact with the white world, and they would still be living very, very primitively, and most of them do. In the countryside, there's no electricity. You know, you pass a lot of little villages with, you know, very primitive huts, thatch roof huts, no electricity, no running water that I could see. You know, it does exist in the bigger towns and in the big cities, but in the countryside, no, it's still very, very primitive.
And, right.
So, yeah.
And
So
then finally, would you go back to Africa?
that's a good question. You know, I would. The one reason I would, well, first of all, the whole international travel scene has become so difficult these days. You know, I've said before, I didn't even want to deal with TSA. I'm just so fed up with airports, and that was back in 2019 before all this COVID crap started. But if I could turn back the clock, the only thing that would prevent me from going back is malaria. I just that was my one big bugaboo. The one thing, it's really, really rife all over Africa. A lot of people, as I said earlier, every 30 seconds a black African dies of malaria, and you just have to take really, really. I took extreme precautions to avoid being bitten, but I did get bitten one night. I got bitten very badly. I was telling you about when I was sleeping on the coast of Kenya. Where and that was high risk malaria country. It was so hot that in my tent that I had to throw open the door, unzip everything, keep the door open just to get some kind of ventilation. And I remember I covered my whole body. I slept in my pants, socks, long sleeve shirt, and I put socks over my hands. But the little bastards, they got through, and in the open slits of my long sleeve shirt, you know, near my on my forearm, I got bitten about 15 times there. And I really consider myself lucky that I didn't pick up malaria. I don't know how I avoided it, but that was really the one that was really bad as far as being bitten. But that's the one thing that would prevent me from going back is malaria. Certain countries I would like.
I was going to say you still got no problem trekking by foot through the
No.
Congo and sleeping.
No, oh God, no, I wouldn't. No, that's too crazy. That's a once in a lifetime thing. But I'm looking at the map now. I would go back. There's some countries that I would love. I'm sorry I missed out on Mali. I've spoken to people that have traveled there. They absolutely loved it, which is right next door to Niger. Some countries in West Africa. I'm looking at the map right now. Senegal, I would like to see. Ethiopia, I've heard everybody that goes there seems to love it. Now here and there, I haven't been to Uganda. I would have loved to go there, but to go on one of those gorilla treks. Actually, we did a gorilla trek in the Congo, and we did see one gorilla. It was an incredible experience. But then you have there's poachers and stuff. I mean, there are all kinds of dangers in Africa that could just creep up on you. That you know, anything could happen. Be it a sudden tribal war. Or poachers, or malaria. I mean,
Or a
but I'm.
hippopotamus, or a lion,
Oh
or
God, I could tell you stories about that too.
Yeah,
I have
no, I
some
know.
pretty.
Yeah, I
Now
read
Dan,
about it.
we had one when I was with Wales. Well, that happened in Southern Africa. We had one close call with an elephant, and actually one with a baboon in Tanzania. We were driving along, and we see this baboon sitting against a tree. So everybody starts taking pictures. All of a sudden, he just walks over and he pulls himself up on the ledge of the truck, which was an open air truck. The tarpaulin was rolled up, and he just bared his fangs and he hissed at everybody. And it was, let me tell you, they're big animals and they have big fangs, and that was pretty damn scary. People started panicking. People, you know, somebody yelled, "Grab the broom!" Then somebody thought very quickly to flip a banana out on the road. And then he did. They did that, and he scampered down. Then we just screamed at the driver. The driver couldn't see what was going on, so we just screamed at him to just leave, hit the gas, and he just did. He didn't know what was going on, but that was scary.
Oh man, it sounds
You have a
scary.
baboon like that, like 5 feet away from you,
Well,
and
I can say with a lot of confidence that I think I'll pass on a trip to Africa, but I don't mind hearing you talk about it. I don't mind watching YouTube videos about it. I was also going to mention, I'll send you a link to it. There's a great YouTube channel called Indigo Traveler. I don't know if you've seen this channel on YouTube or seen any of his videos, but this guy goes all over. He goes to the most remote places. He's been to like North Korea, I'm pretty sure. I know he's been to Iran and Afghanistan and all over the place, all over Africa. And he's got some really, really incredible videos that.
Indigo, you said? I haven't heard of that.
Indigo Traveler, yeah. I think he's from New Zealand.
Okay.
So anyways,
Yeah, there are.
I'll put a link to it when I post the program, and I'll also send you a link in an email if you're interested in checking it out. It's really interesting stuff.
Okay.
But yeah, man, no, we'll do this again. Definitely pick up. I mean, like I said, I have quite a few notes that we didn't even get a chance to really address at all. So when we do the next program, we'll just kind of pick up right where we left off.
Okay, sounds good.
All right,
Okay,
John,
John.
thanks, man. Yep, have a great weekend, and I'll talk to you
Okay,
later.
you too.
Okay,
Very good.
bye.
Bye-bye.